Welcome to Behavior Grooves. My name is Kurt Nelson.
And I'm Tim Houlihan. We are building a community of people interested in positively applying behavioral science to their work and life. We do this by having fun and engaging conversations with a wide variety of people. In this episode, we are continuing our series with Carnegie Mellon researchers and sharing a conversation we recorded with Professor Sylvia Sicardo.
Sylvia is interested in understanding how motivated cognition shapes ethical and unethical decision-making. She focuses on corruption, dishonesty, and discrimination, and her research on bribery and lying has been published in top peer-reviewed journals. She has even co-authored papers with one of our favorite Behavior Grooves guests, Dr. Christina Grobert. While in Pittsburgh, we also had the privilege of guest lecturing Sylvia's class full of uber-engaged and enthusiastic students. It was a treat.
Truly. In our discussion with Sylvia, we talked about how she researches hidden biases, and she told us about how she uses the dictator game to put people in situations where they're not always choosing between a good and a bad option, but between two relatively bad choices.
And Tim, that never happens in real life, does it?
Never.
After our recorded discussion with Sylvia, Tim and I groove on how, depending on the circumstances, small acts of kindness might be small acts of bribery and how they impact our behaviors at work. So, without further ado, sit back and enjoy another episode in our Carnegie Mellon series with Professor Sylvia Sicardo.
Welcome, Sylvia Sicardo, to the Behavioral Grooves podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You were doing great so far. So we're going to have a little speed round. So, Monet or Michelangelo?
Monet.
Tea or coffee?
Coffee.
Pizza or pasta?
Pizza.
Baby Shark or Andrea Bocelli to put your child to sleep?
Andrea Bocelli.
And is that just for you, or is that for your baby, actually?
I guess both.
That's what we figured. All right.
That's good. Okay. Well, so let's start by talking a little bit about your portfolio of work. What, tell listeners who are not familiar with your work, kind of what you're working on and what your research interests are.
Yes. So I'm interested in general in research that helps promoting social good. In particular, I have a lot of projects around understanding what drives individuals to make ethical or rather unethical decisions. Mm. I studied this in the domain of corruption or bribery, deception, discrimination, advice. So that's a broad area of interest of mine. I'm also interested in prosocial behavior, and I'm also interested in behavior change. And maybe later there will be some time to tell you a little bit more about why I'm interested in that.
We will get into behavior change. So, talk about some of the work you've done on ethical or unethical behavior. What are some of the things that you researched in that area?
Well, so when you think about ethical behavior, if you take the economics perspective, individuals should just behave unethically every time. That helps achieving an advantage, all else equal. So if you instead take the Kant perspective, mm-hmm. Then you will think, well, philosophers, moral philosophers think like people should never lie.
Right.
Research in judgment and decision making takes the perspective of individuals might be influenced by the context. And a lot of the research I'm doing looks at, well, individuals also care to perceive themselves as ethical, to see themselves as ethical, honest, well-meaning individuals. Mm-hmm. But whenever they can preserve this positive self-image, but at the same time achieve an economic advantage, they might actually behave unethically. And so a lot of my work looks at how this ability to self-deceive or convincing individuals' ability to convince themselves that they are honest, ethical, good moral people,
allows them to self-deceive, to actually, right. Intentionally, like, I'm going to deceive myself so that I can continue to believe this.
So it's an interesting point. Like, it's not clear whether people are consciously doing it or unconsciously doing it, right? Mm-hmm. In order to self-deceive, and it's interesting, I have like some new ideas on this, but in order to self-deceive, if you can't do it if you're fully conscious that you are going to self-deceive, right?
Right.
So there has to be some sort of like unconscious component.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Okay, so where, in what contexts are you? What context are you studying this? These changes and these economic influences that impact our ethical choices?
Right. So I have a project looking at this in the domain of financial advice. Imagine an advisor who has to make a recommendation to a client, mm-hmm. about the quality of different options. And the advisor might be paid a fixed fee for making this recommendation, or he might receive a commission, right?
Yes.
If he or she recommends one of the two products. Mm-hmm. Now imagine the commission goes, is paid off to the advisor only if the advisor recommends the inferior product. Mm. Well, what I show is that if the quality of the two products is quite subjective, so it's hard for people to truly say which one is the best product, though they might have some ideas, they have room for self-deception. They have room for convincing themselves that the worst product is actually the best. And if commissions are paid out, they might just, like, of course, respond to incentive and recommend this product. Now, how do I show that it's self-deception? Well, what we do in this experiment, which is joint work with researchers at UC San Diego, Uri Gnisi and Marta Sara Garcia, and Ruhlwald and Dyson from Berlin, we actually look at a situation in which the advisor receives the incentive before he has a chance to evaluate the products he will have to judge.
Okay.
So in this case, the advisor is informed, he will get a commission if he recommends product A, let's say. And then he learns about the product, and then he makes the recommendation. And over here, we see a lot of biased recommendations towards the incentive. Now, we compare this treatment with a situation in which the advisor instead receive the commission after having a chance to evaluate the quality of the products. In this situation, if the advisor, like, first has a chance to see for himself which one is really the best product, he doesn't have to write it down, he just can see it for himself, and then learns about the commission, we see that the bias in recommendations is reduced.
Mm. Wow. Wow. So that having an understanding of the product influences our willingness to self-deceive?
Basically. Right. Having a chance to evaluate for yourself which one is actually the ethical option, right? Which one is the ethical recommendation.
So is there a bit of motivated reasoning then that goes into that? They're seeing the financial gain that they could potentially make, so they're then, you know, having some confirmation bias in how they're interpreting that information?
We definitely, like, there is a self-serving bias, right?
Yep.
Like, people can see the incentive, then see the products, and then the incentive, like, actually affect the way they judge the product, right?
So, yeah.
And that's what we see, like, what we think, like, allows them to convince themselves that
right.
they're making the ethical recommendation.
Right.
I have a similar manipulation in an experiment that looks at bribery.
Yes, this is interesting. We were talking about this earlier. So.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, bribes are, of course, like, distortionary.
Yep.
And in one of my projects, I look at how does receiving a bribe affect the decisions of a person in a position of power.
Okay.
Imagine a judge making a decision. And so we have this experiment in which we recruit students to the lab, and we ask them to work on a task, and we have them compete against each other. So imagine, like, pairs of students competing against each other, a third student in the role of the judge. This person judges the quality of the two of the task people
okay.
work on, and then decides who is the winner. The winner gets a monetary prize. and imagine people can bribe the judge.
Okay.
Wow. Are they told this explicitly?
In the experiment, yeah. So it's part of the instructions, which is a question I always get.
Right.
People read the instructions. They learn that they have to do a task. The task is actually writing jokes about economists.
Writing jokes about the economy. I love that.
Well, economists.
Yeah. Economists.
Okay. Well, the economy could have been fun, actually.
Yeah, we thought, like, just wondering how you know, funny those jokes could be just in general, right?
Yeah.
That's terrific, okay.
Right, anyway, so yeah, so they write these jokes and then at some point they are told, they read in the instructions like, well, now you have a chance to add money to your jokes. So the jokes are printed, put in an envelope, and they can add dollar bills from their show-up fee.
Okay.
To the envelope.
Wow. And what happens?
Well, what happens depends on the experimental condition, but going off my previous study, we manipulate the timing at which judges receive the bribe.
Okay.
Before or after they have a chance to read the jokes, in this case. So in one case, the money comes in the envelope with the jokes. The judge opens the envelope, sees the money, then sees the joke, then opens the other envelope, same thing, and then picks a winner. In the other treatment, they first get the jokes, and a few minutes later, they get a second envelope with money. Now, we see that in this latter treatment, the distortion in judgment is much smaller.
Yep.
In the first treatment, almost 90% of the times, judges go with the higher bribe if there is a difference in the two bribes.
And part of that is the subjectivity that these jokes are, right?
Yeah.
And so
going back to
the insurance product, right?
Right?
That if it's a very subjective component, and jokes about economists have to be subjective just by their very
right.
name.
It's a very subjective task,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So it's very easy for people to self-deceive.
Did I tell you the one about the labor economist? No, that's right. Yeah.
Turns out that the jokes weren't very good.
Nice.
Though there was a difference. There
was quite a
large difference, but still.
So the subjectivity is between the worse and worse,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Wow. But the delay between the joke and the bribe made for more moral decisions.
Yeah.
Holy smokes.
Well, and wasn't there some recent research that you were doing that was probably the one where that was the people being bribed and how they were infected?
Right. So as part of this project, we also look at whether referees, like judges, respond to bribes because of money maximization motives, like self-interest, or because of reciprocity, because a lot of, like, it's very intuitive, like you get a bribe and you might want to reciprocate the bribe. And even previous work has found suggested evidence that, yeah, there is reciprocity going on. What we find in our experiment is that we don't see evidence of reciprocity. We see that people are willing to distort their judgment.
Yeah.
So judges are willing to distort their judgment for money, but they're not willing to distort their judgment or lie in order to reciprocate.
Okay.
Wow. That's interesting.
It is.
That's really interesting. So it closely tied to the work, the ethical work, is you talked about pro-social as being another general area of research.
Yeah. I can tell you about some new research I'm doing there. In this work, I'm looking at judgments of pro-social behavior.
Okay.
So, and it's really about morality broad area. So we have individuals. Are you familiar with the dictator game?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but for the listeners, they might not know exactly what the dictator game is.
So the dictator game, it's an economic game in which two participants are assigned to the role either of dictator or of receiver. The participant in the role of dictator is given a sum of money, like imagine $10, and he's told you can keep whatever amount you want and give the rest to the other participant. And this game has been used widely in the literature to study the motives behind generosity and social behavior. So we provide participants with a description of the following scenario. Imagine somebody, say, Chris goes to the lab, to an economics lab, and participates in an experiment, which is the dictator game, and he's matched with another participant and decides to keep all the money for himself.
Okay.
So he gives nothing to the other player. Now, everything is anonymous. The other player doesn't know him. He is a student in a very prestigious private university.
Okay.
After finishing the experiment, Chris leaves the lab and donates everything he earned, including the show-up fee on top of whatever he kept, to charity.
Okay.
Do you like Chris or not?
Oh, wow.
I do.
You do?
I do.
You do? What about you, Tim?
It's hard for me, but I would say yes, because donating everything to a charitable cause, I would see as possibly being better than the exchange between the two.
So, but what got me, and I just, and maybe this is part of where you're going, is he gave his fee for doing it as well. So it was a beyond the $10.
Beyond the $10.
And
yeah.
It was more. He's if it was just the $10,
right.
I don't know if I would have said the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's
interesting. You get an insight into my weird mind.
Okay.
Well, or what norm do we fit into?
Right. So what we do is we present this scenario to participants and ask to judge how moral or social or ethical Chris is.
Yeah.
And we vary what happens inside the game, meaning like Chris keeps everything for himself or splits the money or give everything to the other player. And then we vary what happens outside the game.
Okay.
Meaning he either donates everything to charity or spends everything on himself to buy candies.
Okay.
So now I'll tell you about the other scenario, which is Chris gives everything to the other player and then he goes outside and spends the remaining money, the remaining fee on himself.
Okay.
Do you like Chris?
Oh, I think that that's totally fine. He was paid a fee to go in and do this and he earned that fee and and I like him more because he, during the game, he gave everything to...
Okay, so you like him.
Other,
okay.
I like him, yeah.
What if he splits the money and then spends everything on himself?
Well...
I'm liking Chris less.
You're liking Chris less.
So.
Okay.
Oh, in both instances?
Yes, yeah, both.
See, I think that if he gives everything in the game to the other player and keeps his fee, I feel like he was paid to go and do the game... And he was paid a fee to go and do that, and I think that that's okay.
That he keeps that. I might have a different decision if I would have heard this first, but I heard the other one first,
right.
And so now I don't like Chris
so
much.
You don't like Chris so much.
Okay, huh? Okay, so we present. That's crucial for our design. We present people only with one of those scenarios.
Yep.
What we find is that people like Chris much, much less. If he keeps everything for himself and then donates to charity.
Interesting.
So people don't like a version of Chris who keeps everything and does something good, and gives the money to whoever is more needy, right?
It's
gives it to charity. And so we are like trying to understand this phenomenon. And one of the things that makes the fact go away is we bring the charity inside the game.
Ah.
So we think it's a story about narrow or versus broad bracketing, like how people think about the scenario, whether they think about it all together as part of a broad bracket versus like as two separate actions that Chris does.
Right.
So if we bring the charity inside the game and now Chris gives nothing to the other player but everything to charity, now people start to like him. But if he does exactly the same, but the charity is outside the game, people don't like him.
That's fascinating.
The charity is inside the game, that is so interesting.
Yeah.
So what about the broad versus narrow bracketing makes Chris more likable because it's inside the game? What happens there?
What happens there, like, good question. We are like trying, it's very new, exciting work. We are trying to understand what happens inside the game now.
Well, because, I mean, that, you can think about how this plays into other realms of our life when we're doing a variety of different things. Like even our own component of we're working with somebody and, you know, we might get a bonus from work and do we Is there some internal mechanism to give some of that bonuses to a charity, or do we take it home and give it to a charity then? And that's way off topic.
Yeah, but it's interesting. Yeah,
but there are like, just those fascinating components, yeah. And would people more likely give anyway? I think there could be lots of components.
I worked with a sales guy who relied on a team of people to complete the sale, mm-hmm. And he was able to make this great big sale. There was a large commission in it for him, but no other financial benefits to anyone else on the team. Uh-huh. He took some of his commission and bought presents or prizes for the people on his team. They didn't select anything, and they weren't expecting it either. So he went and just, out of his own money. And the love and affection that they all had for him at that point was huge. You know, they thought he was tremendously generous to use some of his own commission and share it. The other hand is that he couldn't have actually completed the sale without them doing the work.
Right.
They were integral to it. Mm-hmm. And yet it always surprised me that they were willing to say, my work was important, but that's the job that I got hired to do. But now that I'm getting this reward, I actually like this sales rep more. And in some ways, he was buying their affections because they also worked on other teams.
Well, and it'd be interesting. Well, yeah, they're working on other teams with other salespeople.
With other salespeople.
So now there's a relative component of is you know, salesperson A better than salesperson B because they've now given them a gift, a bribe.
Right.
Yeah. And how much is that bribe relative to the total commission? Mm-hmm. And is it minuscule, or is it, you know, did he take 30% of his commission and make it into prizes? I doubt it, right? But anyway. Fascinating stuff.
Okay. Yeah.
Sorry, we digress.
That's a lot with our whole component here. It is super interesting.
Okay, so
is there other new research that you're doing? Anything that you think is really fascinating?
Before we go there, can I tell you very fast about another prosocial kind
of course.
Yes, please
project?
Do.
Or
please
like
do.
This has to do with discrimination.
Okay.
And a lot of economists use dictator games, now that I introduced the game, it's even easier, to study preferences towards outgroup, which could be a proxy for, like, you know, discrimination if there is, like, differential preferences towards an in-group versus an outgroup. Like, the dictator game could help, like, understand, like, whether there is taste-based discrimination going on. What we do in this experiment is, again, like when you think about being pro-social towards somebody else, especially if it's like an out-group, it's hard to imagine individuals actively like discriminating or actively being selfish because it's such a like obvious behavior. Like, you know, like the game is so simple, it's really hard to discriminate in a game like that, right? And a lot of researchers look at this game and say, like, oh, there is no discrimination, like even the discrimination we see in markets, there is no evidence of taste-based discrimination because if you look at the dictator game, there is no difference when you put people
in group, out group,
in group, out group. So in our study, we think again, like, well, individuals might want to be perceived as people who are like who have good intention, they don't discriminate, but if there are excuses, they might actually engage in discrimination. And to show this, we have a very simple experiment where people are matched with another participant from a different ethnicity.
Okay.
So we do it in Germany, it's either Germans or Turks. So you're either matched with another German or matched with a Turkish participant. And we ask people to play the dictator game. Over there is no difference. Again.
Okay.
Then we make a small modification to the dictator game such that in order to be nice to the other person, instead of having to just make a simple choice, people could have to do something unethical, tell a small white lie.
Oh.
So you can be nice to the other participant, but in order to be nice, you have to violate a moral norm of not lying, even though the lie is pro-social. So pro-social lies are quite interesting because they contain different norms, right? One is like, oh, I can tell the lie and be nice to the other person, or I can be honest and not lie. So what we see is that people self-servingly choose whether to lie or not. Self-servingly meaning like they just do that based on the ethnicity of the receiver. So if they're matched with a participant of the same ethnicity, they are willing to tell a lie in order to be nice to the other person. But if they're matched with a minority, everybody suddenly becomes honest. And so they are no longer willing to tell a social lie, which results in discrimination. So now...
Wow. So is a pro-social lie like I greet Kurt and I say, wow, Kurt, your vest looks really great today, but I'm actually lying to him because I actually don't think it looks great today.
Well, could be one sort of pro-social lie, but another sort of, in our we operationalize it in our game, it's simply like if you lie, if you tell a lie about some external outcome, like the outcome of a die roll, but it could be anything.
Okay.
The other participant gets $15 and you get 9. But if you tell the truth, he gets 10 and you get 10. So you tend to lie and sacrifice the $1 when you're matched with the same in-group. But if you're matched with a minority, then everybody uses the excuse of not being, not wanting to be dishonest.
Right. And how are the participants informed about the ethnicity of the person that they're playing with?
We use an approach that has been used in the literature before. We just provide them with the first name. And usually people can infer the ethnicity based on
the first name. And again, in the dictator game, these people are anonymous. So there isn't any component where I might, because they're in group, I might feel like I would run into that person at some later time. They have no idea who this is.
Everything is so online. It's anonymous.
And so that component of it doesn't get, there's not a reciprocity again, right? There's no chance that that comes into play. What this is really about is that pro-social behavior. And it's really interesting that it gets changed when you have to get that moral component in. Just around ethnicity. That seems fascinating. And so has there been any hypothesis around the why? What is the reason for that difference? Are you looking at that?
Yeah, well, we are still looking at it, and again, it's like in progress work.
Yep.
But we think people have this strong motive of appearing good in front of others as well as themselves, right? We don't think like people intentionally discriminate in this situation, but might just like truly convince themselves that I want to be honest.
Yeah.
And this allows them to be less nice to the minority, but without really feeling bad about it.
Got it.
Now, this is just a simple experiment, but if you think about potential applications in the real world, there are many situations in which quality has to be judged again. Mm-hmm. Quality is subjective, and individuals might just come up with excuses to give a promotion or not without feeling bad about, without feeling that they are discriminating.
Which of these two people will get the interview? Will it be an in-group person or an out-group person?
Right.
Or even feedback on their performance, right? You have an in-group person, out-group performer, you're going to feel more likely to, again, deceive yourself potentially on that in-group person than on an out-group person. Again, fascinating stuff. All right, so we interrupted the comment on other new research. So
or anything else from the portfolio that you think?
Yeah, anything that you think would be interesting.
Well, I have a new work that is on a completely different domain. I said I care about promoting social good, and this work is about getting people to be healthier or having them engaging behaviors that are good for them. And in particular, I'm very excited about a new project on sleep.
Okay, so sleep.
So did you know that 1/3 of Americans self-report that they don't sleep enough?
1/3of all Americans self-report they do not sleep enough.
Mm-hmm. And sleep, it's like really has been declared a public health epidemic.
Yeah. So there's three of us here, and I'm raising my hand.
Oh, I'm raising my hand. I have a baby.
You have a baby.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's understandable.
I don't mean to say sleep is circumstantial. I mean, to some degree, right?
Yeah.
But Kurt, you've had challenges.
We've talked about this. Yes.
Yeah.
So
not a good sleeper.
Yeah, so sleep, it's important, right?
Yes.
There are huge health implications,
right.
Performance potential implications. I, together with a group of other researchers, we decided to study sleep. I was teaching for the first time here at Carnegie Mellon, and the very first time I was assigned to this 9 a.m. class. I didn't choose my time. And 9 a.m., it's the worst time, on a Monday morning.
A Monday morning 9 a.m. class.
Yeah. So
at
my
university.
Students,
yeah, I think we can all agree that that's the worst time.
Right.
Yeah.
It wasn't good. And then, like, I teach behavior change as well, and I ask my students what's the behavior, like, if you could choose one behavior where you could improve, which one is it? And people were like, I want to sleep more.
Yeah.
So that got me interested, and I found some collaborators who were already doing some sleep research, and together we teamed up and decided to study what can we do to improve sleep in college students.
Okay.
So we are currently starting to run a big experiment where we track people's sleep using Fitbits.
Okay.
Okay.
And we developed a smartphone app that connects to the Fitbit and is able to give feedback and send reminders about, like, feedback on how much people slept, and send reminders like telling people, oh, it's time to go to sleep. And on top of that, we are studying the effect of different behavioral interventions using this app.
Wow.
That sounds very exciting. That sounds really cool.
Well, we're going to have to come back and find out more about that once you get the research done and
I would love
it.
To do that.
Yes.
Good. So, again, I'm always glancing at Kurt when it comes to talking about music.
Just to
see. You have, a baby in the house. Mm-hmm. And so your musical world is dominated by what's going to work in the, with a baby around, right?
Right. My baby currently dictates any music we listen at home.
Right.
Everything that makes him happy or makes him fall asleep.
Fall asleep is very important when you have a seven-month-old, right? So there you go.
Yeah.
And so what is it that puts your child to sleep?
Okay, so I answered to this earlier, right?
Yep.
So Andrea Bocelli currently is something that puts him to sleep. If he wants to laugh or if he's upset, I put on Baby Shark and then he's happy.
And it works to a large degree.
Oh, it does, completely. Like, he dances all the time when I put it on. So
well and this is a topic that we go into quite often, is music as a element to change our mood or to influence how we show up. And, as adults, we use it from a priming perspective. We've talked to people about, do you use music to, if you're trying to write, or do you use music if you're trying to, get excited about going up and presenting in front of somebody in various different modes. And so, at that even youngest level, there's some components that say, yes, this type of music is for sleeping. This type of music is to, have some happy thoughts.
Oh yeah, completely.
I think it's amazing that our brains are maybe not hardwired, right, but we certainly have responses to particular types of music in very predictable ways.
Yeah, and I could observe it like a very, very early age. So my husband will just play the guitar and the baby would be fine, right? So
So he's a guitar player and does
No, he's not. He just learned for the babies.
Okay.
There's some motivation, right?
Yeah.
Learn how to play the guitar.
Yeah.
So imagine that no one's in the house and you get to just listen to whatever music that you want to listen to.
That hasn't happened in forever.
Dream.
Would say, I put on, because sometimes I get homesick, like, thinking about Italy, so I put on some Italian music.
Yeah, so like what? What would you listen to?
Well, you wouldn't know, but like Jovanotti, it's like an Italian singer.
Okay.
And
is it pop music? Is it more classical? How would you describe?
More like rap mostly. Oh. Yeah, but
Italian rap.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. It got more like pop later on, but yeah.
Okay.
So that's like, you know, the music. This particular singer has been around for a while, so like I was in Italy when he was popular, and then like he's still popular, but like, you know, so yeah. It's nice to listen.
Well, we've talked about that too. Is that music that we heard or that we liked when we were in some formative stages, and how often, by as you said, you get maybe a little bit homesick, and you put that music on, and how it brings us back into the emotions and kind of the feelings that we had in those years. And I think it's really fascinating, again, as to how that psychology of music works. And so
It is. Well, and you grew up near Venice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Vivaldi is just, you know, one of the greatest composers, yeah, right, ever. And most of his pieces were actually first launched in Venice, at all some of the most beautiful places, you know, in the world. So,
yeah.
Do you connect to someone like Vivaldi because of sort of the proximity to where you grew up?
I mean, I would say, like, yes, but not necessarily, like, I mean, like, you would be sure, everybody imagines, like, Italy, like, it's all, like, classical music, but
No. It's a modern world.
All right, so I'm gonna turn this on you. Are you just a huge Prince fan because you grew, or, you know, are in Minnesota?
I didn't grow up here. I didn't actually become a Prince fan until I moved to Minnesota.
Okay.
Oh, all right. Interesting.
And then I got a chance to record at Paisley Park, and so I got to be around that, you know, that creative space, and became a huge Prince fan in those years. Yeah.
I think I find it very interesting about space and locale and the type of music that is there, and again how that permeates the local culture, and does that necessarily, you know, translate further. So
proximity is so fascinating. That, like, Barry Ritholtz talked about how investors are more likely to invest in businesses that are close to their home or their industry that they're in than they are something that's very different.
So Midwest is more agriculture and various different things, where East Coast is more banks, or West Coast is more tech.
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. We digress.
We did. Okay, Sylvia, thank you. We appreciate your time very much. And this was really fun.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
And we're going to have you back when you find out more about the sleep study, because I want to know.
Yeah. I promise I will be back.
All right, fantastic.
Okay, good.
Welcome to our grooving session, where Tim and I groove on what we learned from our behavior groups interview, have a free-flowing discussion on some of those topics, and whatever else comes into our bribe-induced brains.
Ooh. Man, I just hear dark music.
Do you want some cashews
right now before we start talking?
There we go.
So we're going to talk about timing, right?
Yes.
So I think we should talk about the judges and bribing and the timing of gifts.
Yeah, and in an organizational perspective, how that works. Okay, what else should we groove on?
Dictator game.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, dictator game. Let's talk about the implications of that. And I got a music issue for you. We have talked about this in the past a little bit, but let's get a little deeper into the music at work question.
Great.
Okay.
Sounds good. All right. So,
yeah. So start. Give me your thoughts on the bribing issue.
So Sylvia brought up the component of some of her research that looked at the timing of bribes with those judges, whether that was on the, the jokes about economists and various other things in this whole component.
How great was that?
But this element of having bribe before or a bribe after reviewing the joke, right? And the impact that had. It was interesting. So thinking about that from an organizational perspective, right? When you are going in an organization and you know, you often have a client that you're already working with, and maybe you're going to propose or do a sales pitch for another opportunity with that client.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes you will have dinner or something along with that client.
Maybe you flew into that city the day before this big presentation, and so you say, hey, Mr. Ms. Client, let's go out to dinner the night before the presentation.
So is there an ethical component of, hey, let's go the night before the sales presentation out to dinner. Hey, we'll pay. Or do we go out the night after? We've done the sales presentation. Great. That was fantastic. Now let's go out for dinner. Or do we even go out to dinner at all?
At all. Right. Well, and you and I have been through many years of this, and we know that there are some companies that have very strict regulations about what they are willing to accept, what they are able to accept, policies that define what a gift is and what a gift is not.
Right.
And I also know plenty of people in the business world who kind of eschew those and just skip right over those policies if it's not convenient or doesn't appeal to them.
So from a perspective of influence, right, the dinner the night before, you know, using this as an analogy again, not sure exactly if it correlates,
right.
But it would
right. This
appear,
is not Sylvia's research.
So. Right. But it would appear that the dinner the night before would be more influential in you having a better perception of, or the clients having a better perception of that sales presentation.
Absolutely. And if nothing else, business leaders should be aware of that, whether they're in the selling or the buying mode.
Yeah. And in the buying mode, it's a really important component because, again, you may not necessarily take that into account, right?
That's right.
So, and it goes into, you know, a lot of the pharma sales reps used to do dinners and lunches and giving trinkets and different things and those gifts. And you go, wow, is a pen really going to impact how a physician, what drugs they write? And you go, there's no way. I mean, just cognitively thinking about that, a pen is not going to influence whether I write product A or product B for this very serious, you know, illness or, you know, that, but in reality, it does.
It does. We know that the socks that you wear prime you for how you're feeling.
Oh, yes.
And, oh, it looks like Einstein socks today.
I'm trying to be smart.
Okay. So let's, so the big takeaway is business leaders need to be aware.
Business leaders need to be aware. And to that, you talked about some organizations have policies in place and either enforce those policies, look at those policies. So
update
it's more
them.
than being aware, it is putting some procedures and policies in place to potentially make sure that you're not being influenced unduly in those situations by those bribes of dinner or cashews.
Okay, let's talk about the dictator game.
Yeah, so the dictator game, you know, again, really an interesting component. The dictator game is this game where you as an individual are given some money and you have the opportunity to either keep that money for yourself or give some of it away or all of it away to another participant in the dictator game.
Yeah, typically just one other component and it's anonymous, it's online.
It's anonymous and you never meet that person, you don't know who they are,
right.
They'll never know you, so it's there's the component and different things. The twist that Sylvia brings up is that, hey, instead, as you're thinking about the dictator game, right? So if Chris or the participant in it wins, right, and they get that winning, and when they then go out and take all of their winnings plus whatever pay they got for participating in this, so say they won $10, but they also got $2 for participating, so that's $12, and they gave that to charity. Ah, great for them. Or they could, you know, keep none of the winnings and just give the $10 to their opponents, right?
That's right.
Or they could keep it all and give none to charity or none to their opponent.
That's right. Keep the fees and keep the winnings all for themselves.
Right. And so in that situation, when people gave to the charity, people viewing the person who gave it, they felt that, hey, giving to the charity, that person's much nicer and various different things. But then they added in this twist.
Yeah.
And they added in the twist of saying, can you now, as part of the dictator game, give to the charity inside of the dictator game?
Right.
And when that happened,
people like Chris more. They like the person who is making the choice better when it's within the game, even though Chris wasn't able to give away his fee.
Right.
So actually, when the gift to the charity is outside of the game itself, Chris was able to give his fee and the charity and
so
his winnings.
So gave $12 to charity.
Versus just 10.
Just inside the game, it's 10.
But we like him better when that choice is made within the game.
Yeah.
So what are the implications in the corporate world that might come from this?
Well, I don't know if there's implications, but it lends itself to an idea. So what if in an incentive, you gave, you know, in an incentive, somebody, a salesperson, an employee, whatever, they do something, they make $5,000. They could give that $5,000 or a portion of that $5,000 to charity. What if, as part of the design of the incentive, at the beginning of the year, beginning of the quarter, you have an opportunity to earn $5,000? Do you want it all for yourself, or do you want a certain percentage of that incentive to go to a charity of your choice? Would that have an impact on how, A, taking this research into account, on how people feel about that, and the incentives in general, and them and others within there? And also, you know, is there a component of like the save more tomorrow piece where you're putting that up in front? Would that give more to charity, do you think?
Well, it sounds like we've got a choice architecture opportunity here, right? And we've also got a question about which would be the default. Imagine if the employee, the sales rep, for instance, who has this opportunity to earn, gets the acknowledgement that he or she is now enrolled in the sales incentive, but she needs to choose, and the default is 85% of the winnings come to her and 15% go to a charity of her choice.
Yeah.
What would that be like?
That would be interesting. And do it with that charity component, what's the motivational, is there more motivation?
Right.
Because there has been some research out right there that says, hey, incentives that are given to charity, particularly short-term ones, often have a higher motivational value.
Very strong.
than necessarily getting that same amount for yourself, particularly when they're smaller in monetary component.
Yeah, I think some of the work that Charlotte Blank has been doing recently shows that these pro-social rewards have a very positive effect on motivation.
Right. And so it's interesting to think about that from an incentive design perspective. You know, and I've actually, you know, this component of thinking about, well, as a rep, right? So say I'm a salesperson, and we talked a little bit about, you know, what if that rep gave some of their earnings to another coworker inside their team, somebody who didn't earn that commission.
And
right?
You've actually had this experience.
Right? I have had this experience. So when I started off, when I was a young pup of, you know, making no money, the as I like to say, I was probably the lowest paid MBA graduate of the University of Iowa in 1992.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I am very proud of that.
We should get you a medal for that.
I believe that by far I was by a magnitude of many factors. Long story short, I was working very hard and very diligently, and a mentor of mine who actually, I was about ready to quit my job at BI, and I ended up staying with BI because this mentor, Fred Baumer, kind of took me under his wing and got me getting out of this marketing coordinator job into more of this organizational development work and doing some really cool strategy and experiential training and all these other things. And so I did a lot of work on both sides, but I was doing, you know, two jobs in one. And again, I didn't have an incentive opportunity. Fred did. And Fred, one year, was very generous, and he had earned an incentive, and he gave me $500, which at the time was huge. And I mean, it made me cry. I remember it to this day.
Huge emotional
I was
impact
like huge and oh my gosh, it was wonderful from my perspective, and I felt such an affinity and kind of, you know, this element of saying just thankfulness and gratitude to that, because that at that point, you know, I wasn't expecting it. It wasn't part of this planned component, but man, it made a difference in my life.
So on the other side of that is a situation where a sales rep at an organization relied on a team of people to build both the design and then the implementation of the what they were selling, and the team under the sales rep did and they did not report to the sales rep. They reported independently, but they did not have an opportunity to get the same kind of bonus that the sales rep had.
Right.
And in this one situation, the sales rep reaps a large bonus from the work that was done collectively by the team,
right,
buys gifts for the people on the team, and then is reprimanded by the CEO of the company because those people on the team could also work with other sales reps. Mm. And the CEO made the case that that the sales rep was buying those people's affections.
He was bribing them.
He was bribing them in a way that wanted them that gave them incentive to want to do more work with this particular sales rep and not other sales reps.
Right. So this sales rep, she or he was saying, "Hey, thank you," but from a CEO's perspective, it wasn't a thank you. It was this bribe to say,
"Right,
I'm going to try to make sure I work with this salesperson as opposed to these others who aren't giving me these nice gifts."
Right. So interesting ethical implications depending on some of the nuances in the story.
Yeah, and you have to wonder from an organization's perspective. A, are you designing your team rewards appropriately if that is indeed
Absolutely.
The case? That
Absolutely.
there's a need for that or a perceived need by that rep. And then B, are we taking away – yes, bribes are important – not important, but bribes are
– In some ways, they're really important.
Bribes are real, right? And they do influence. But there's also this component of just humanness of – thank you, this grant. Yeah. I mean, from my perspective, you know, I also worked with other people. I don't know if maybe I did. Maybe I didn't put as much energy or effort or conscious, you know, work into that versus my work with Fred. But I also just felt this general sincerity. But I also just felt this general sincerity and gratitude. And to a point, it kept me in that working in that job because I was seriously at a point where I was considering leaving, and because of that, I it was one piece that kept me from leaving, and I was just grateful.
Yeah.
And there's a human element that says, you know, and I've thought about that in my work subsequent. And
so reciprocity is a good thing, right?
It is a good thing.
We want that. We need it. We rely on it.
Yeah.
There is a line to be drawn between reciprocity and bribery, though.
Yeah.
Right? There's a line that we don't want to cross.
So
from an ethical perspective.
I'd be interested in any listeners in any situations that they might have had where there was maybe an ethical line mm-hmm. in a reward, bonus, gift, some sort of thing. And do you think, you know, were their lines crossed or were there not? And again, you can reach out to Tim or me on Twitter or LinkedIn or just send us an email and we'd be happy to have that conversation. Because I think it's not black and white. I don't know if it's a solid line. I think there's this...
Well, that's part of the discussion.
Big wide gray line that has varying degrees of blackness
and grayness.
Grayness and different things around it. So yeah. All right. So music. I have been sending you some variety of different research, you know, like links to different things that we've talked about in the past about do you listen to music at work? And there's been some recent articles about that.
So there is some research on some functionality, right, that goes along with it. And in general, it kind of breaks down into two parts. We've got work that is redundant, and we've got work that is cognitive intensive.
Right. You know? So work that I don't really need to use my brain too seriously on to think about it versus work where I need to really focus.
Yeah. So if I'm doing something repetitive, if I'm doing the same job over and over and over again, and I'm used to it, then this research says that listening to music is a really good thing.
Yeah, it actually makes you more productive.
Makes you more productive. In fact, it kind of takes me back to a lesson from the 1930s Disney film Cinderella, where the dwarves are singing "Whistle While You Work."
Oh,
because it makes the day go by faster. And that's my experience. If I'm shoveling snow, or if I'm sweeping
in April.
Oh my God!
We just got 8 inches of snow here in April 12th in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Unbelievable!
So there you go. Anyway, you're whistling while you're shoveling snow.
I like to whistle, but most of the time I'm just listening to music.
Okay.
and I can listen to music pretty intensely, actually, when I'm doing that, because the work in itself isn't critical and require a lot of cognitive space.
And for you, that was important, because we've talked about this work before, and you said, no, because I get into the music, and so therefore it doesn't allow me to work, which is actually what the research kind of found. It said when you need to focus and have some cognitive component, music is a hindrance, and particularly if it's music that you're familiar with and you know, and there's lyrics, that it drives down productivity. So
absolutely.
So my thing of listening to music while working is counterproductive to me. So I might have to think about that.
Or you just have a lot of redundant tasks to do in your life.
I might just be redundant. Who knows, right?
So listeners, thanks for hanging with us for another grooving session and a wonderful discussion with Sylvia Sicardo.
And with that, keep on grooving.